From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made about a week ago when the American Academy of Pediatrics came out with advice about reopening schools this fall. The AAP says, if at all possible, kids should be in physical classrooms with their peers. And the Academy points out that we've learned a lot since March, when most schools shut down. We know more about the virus, how it spreads, how to test for it, and what to do in case of positive tests. Dr. Sean O'Leary helped write the Academy guidelines. He told the New York Times, quote, reopening schools is so important for the kids, but really for the entire community. So much of our world relies on kids being in school and parents being able to work. And this virus is different from most of the respiratory viruses we deal with every year. School-age kids clearly play a role in driving influenza rates within communities. That doesn't seem to be the case with COVID-19, end quote. Dr. O'Leary is not saying kids can't get it or that there are zero risks, but he's saying there can be a balance with kids back in school in most places this September. Yesterday, we heard from three local superintendents. It was the start of what will be a series of conversations with school leaders, superintendents, doctors. We'll talk to teachers, parents, because this remains one of the most complex problems that this country has to try to solve for the fall. Today, we welcome doctors who can help us understand the best ways to support our kids no matter what decisions are made. Welcome to Dr. Dave Topa, a pediatrician at Pittsford Pediatric Associates. Dr. Topa, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me back. Appreciate it.
Also with us is Dr. Steve Cook, an associate professor of pediatrics and a pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital. Dr. Cook, welcome back to you.
Thank you very much, Evan.
And Dr. Elizabeth Murray is also a professor of pediatrics and a pediatrician at Golisano. And I think, Liz, a spokesperson officially for the AAP in this hour. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Hi, how are you?
You are the AAP. Welcome to the AAP.
Well, one of 67,000 pediatricians.
Okay, well, that's good. I want to say, first of all, thanks to all three of you for bringing your time here. This is important, and I want to just kind of get some opening thoughts from all three doctors. And Dr. Topa, I'll start with you. Your time's a little bit more limited. As we look ahead to the fall, do you have a general sense for, and what we're going to avoid, by the way, we're going to avoid what should happen, because I know you're not policymakers. We want to talk with about how best to support kids and how to understand different possibilities here. Do you have a general sense, Dr. Topa, that what the Academy of Pediatrics published in its guidelines and what Dr. O'Leary told the New York Times is the direction we're going, that at this point there's an expectation that we're going to be ready in some way to have kids in the classroom?
You know what? I think one part of this is it depends on what part of the country that you're in. We're doing a much better job here in Monroe County, I think, and in New York State than other parts of the country in terms of slowing the spread of the virus. So that's an important thing to take into consideration. At the same point, I think it's possible. I just think it's going to take a lot of work on behalf of everyone who's involved in the care of kids, pediatricians, teachers, administrators. It's going to take many hands on deck for this one.
Okay. Dr. Murray, what do you think?
I agree. I think that there's still a lot of hurdles. We are right now in a great place in Monroe County as far as disease spread, and we need to keep it that way. But if we can keep it that way, I'm pretty optimistic that we can get kids onto campus, at least at the start of the school year.
Yeah, and you know, Dr. Cook, to kind of build on Dr. Murray's point, the transmission rate in New York State remains the lowest or one of the lowest in the country statewide. And certainly Monroe County has been lower than New York City, which drove most of the cases in the state for a long time. Saying that on a public radio, I get a little nervous that we're going to instill false confidence. But at least at this moment, Dr. Cook, we are in a pretty good place compared to a lot of places in the country.
Yes, we are. It's definitely something that took a lot of hard work. And requires a lot of persistence. It's not just going to stay like this. We have to work to keep it like this. But by working to keep it like this, we will actually be able to open up more and more as a region, as an economy. So it's really important to balance these things out. It's reassuring, but it shouldn't lead us to let our guard down.
So, listeners, if you've got questions or comments for the doctors on the program this hour, you can call the program. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994, and you can email the program connections@wxxi.org. I want to ask all three of you to weigh in on what we do know about kids and this virus. And Dr. O'Leary was talking to Dana Goldstein of the New York Times about this last week. Does the virus spread among kids? His comments to the New York Times read as follows. He says, and I mentioned some of it in the outset, this virus is different from most of the respiratory viruses we deal with every year. School-age kids clearly play a role in driving influenza rates within communities. That doesn't seem to be the case with COVID-19. And it seems like in countries where they have reopened schools, it plays a much smaller role in driving spread of disease than we would expect. So that's some of what Dr. O'Leary had to say about kids and the spread. We're also looking at studies in which the data on transmission of SARS-CoV-2 from school-age children to adults are limited because most schools have been closed since March, obviously. But many child care centers in the United States have remained open throughout the pandemic to care for the children of frontline workers. And there have been essentially no major recorded coronavirus outbreaks that we have seen directly linked to child care facilities this spring and summer. And some of the most extensive reporting I've seen comes from Iceland, where testing and contact tracing were implemented early during the pandemic, and they revealed only 2 documented cases of child-to-parent transmission, even though elementary schools and daycare centers remained operational there. So, Dr. Topa, again, without trying to get overconfident here, do we have enough data to say that, generally speaking, we know that kids don't suffer from this virus, thank goodness, the way older adults can, and we're now getting enough data to say kids not only don't really suffer if they get it, they don't spread it as much. Can we feel good with that, Dr. Topa?
I think that's appropriate to say at this point. Of course, data is still coming out, and I think we have enough data on hand to try to plan for an in-person return to school in the fall, keeping an eye on the data, of course. You know, I think none of us are going to advocate committing right now to absolutely going back and ignore any other data that becomes available. But at the same point, this is all going to take time. And if we don't start moving on this now, there's no way school is going to be able to open up in the fall. So I think there's enough data now that really pushes us in that direction of being able to plan for an in-person start for schools that will be different than what it was in September of 2019. But I think that if we can go ahead, at least get working on plans, it's going to serve the children well.
And Dr. Topa, has COVID-19 showed up at Pittsford Pediatric Associates and Kids?
You know what? We have not had any one of the children that we've seen in the office that we've tested turn out positive. I think we've had maybe a couple people who traveled somewhere and came back and contacted our office about getting a test, but they were older, and so like more in the late teens, early 20s, and were coming back from another part of the country. But as of now, we haven't had any positive tests come back.
Remarkable. Dr. Murray, you agree with what you're hearing here, that at this point, you know, we can feel, again, I don't know if good is the right word, but good in the knowledge that we're gaining about how this spreads or doesn't spread as much among kids?
Probably. I think that with regards to the American data, it's pretty important to me to remember that these were kids of essential workers. And so I do wonder, you know, is that by nature a population that's a little bit more heightened into the safety and concerns of spread because they knew that they were in their work environment really high risk. Mm-hmm. And so were they taking extra precautions at home? You know, that kind of concept intrigues me a little bit. But I think the bigger issue is that if we can get kids back onto the school campus in this September, no matter what, it's going to look a little bit different, at least a little bit different than it did September of last year. And I think that's a critical thing to remember, that yes, we can probably get them back on campus, but if we do, there are going to be some differences no matter what.
Dr. Cook, what do you think?
I think we're all kind of trending in the right direction. It's important that we stay vigilant to look at this. And I think that's one of the big concerns with summer travel, as Dr. Topa pointed out. We're doing a very good job, and it may not be that cases reemerge in New York from New York as much as people leaving New York and bringing it back into the state. And so that's really important. We have an extensive amount of work around testing, around contact tracing, which is really critical to then identify and isolate those cases and keep it under control. So I like the direction we're going in, but we need to stay vigilant. And it's really important to look at the AAP statement. It talks about social emotional health of children, but opening in a safe way. And that means taking into consideration the health of the teachers, the staff, as well as the students, which,
yeah,
you know, is what further complicates this issue.
Yeah, amen. I mean, at some point when we are in a post-pandemic world, someone will write a really fascinating book on just how complex and strange, frankly, this disease is, and how fortunate many parents feel that it seems to mostly spare kids. So again, I'm just going to keep using that phrase, mostly, a big caveat there. We understand it's not everybody, but it's just, can you imagine if this was like influenza, the way it would impact our society? It's just a totally different deal. And so let's get some of your early phone calls here for our guests, Dr. Dave Topa, Dr. Elizabeth Murray, Dr. Steve Cook, who were with us here. Ellie in Fairport is first. Go ahead, Ellie.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I would love to have my daughter go back to elementary school in the fall, as I know many other people feel that way. But I'm really concerned about the folks who are completely ignoring science and are very, very loudly saying that they are not wearing masks, they are not social distancing, and their children will go back to school no matter what in the fall. And it makes me sort of think about, well, you know, the vaccine requirements, and, you know, if you want to go to school in New York State, you have to adhere to certain regulations. And I'm wondering if there's any sort of parallel that can be drawn between those to make sure that people who are coming to school buildings eventually, once that is decided to do it in a safe way, are in fact practicing safe guidelines outside of the school buildings as well. Is that something that we can police, so to say, to keep everybody safe?
Yeah, Ellie, it's a great set of questions. Thank you for that. And so before I kick it over to the doctors, I will say that, yes, when you see media reports of people blown up, there was a viral video of a guy in Costco at Fort Myers, Florida yesterday who looked like he was ready to snap when an older woman asked him to put a mask on, and he almost got into a physical altercation. It was ridiculous. Yes, those things go viral. That is not most of the population now, thankfully, and we are seeing more, to the extent that this has become politicized, we are seeing more conservative leaders talk about the importance of masking, and we know that the data is really, really solid on that. So I take the concern there, Ellie. I think that we got to be careful to make sure we don't over-amplify the dissenters, even though we want to understand where everybody is in this. And then beyond that, the question is, what can we do as a community? And I don't know how many rules. I mean, Dr. Topa, I don't know how many rules you can set up at school to make sure you know when if kids are coming from households that are either masked up, taking this seriously, you know, following the guidelines. I'm not sure you can do a whole lot outside of the school building. Am I wrong?
Yeah, I don't think there's a whole lot you can do outside of the school building to ensure that families are following recommendations. However, I think it's important to realize that when children that get infected, it looks like when they do get infected, it's from their household contacts. And then if they come to school, they don't necessarily transmit at that point. And if we're able to set up systems where if we detect that an adult in the household has COVID, well, then the children aren't able to come to school. If we are screening for symptoms before kids even get on the bus, and then if we are able to maintain proper spacing, which in the American Academy of Pediatrics document was even suggested to be down to 3 feet, along with, you know, masking and spreading kids out and putting them into pods to be educated, I think if you set up enough criteria here for kids to meet before they can even enter school or stay in school, we can really keep kids from spreading it while they're at school, because in the end, it looks like the data supports that the notion that kids don't really pass this to adults as much as adults will pass it to kids, and only in the household environment.
Yeah, I want to grab a sound cut. It's actually the second sound cut we've queued up from yesterday. This is Dr. Murray, before I kick it over to you, I'm thinking about what Ellie in Fairport is saying about, you know, not knowing about the protocols of families who are sending kids to school and wanting to feel comfortable. And people have asked about staff and testing. I asked Dr. Jean Mancuso, who is the superintendent of Honey, I Falls, Lima, whether the expectation is that if schools reopen, you're going to be testing teachers and staff either right at the outset of the school year or even with any regularity. And here's why he said he doesn't necessarily know that that's doable.
Well, right now I can tell you that I know lots of nurses and doctors who haven't been tested in the local healthcare system, so I don't know how realistic it would be that we're going to test all our educators.
Okay. Dr. Murray, does that make sense to you?
Yes and no. I think it's different. You know, remember, people in healthcare have different types of PPE and they're working in a different way, and it's just a little bit different. I think when it comes to testing teachers, we have to remember that that just gives you information about one point in time. It, you know, it doesn't mean that they're negative forever. And so, you know, I think, I don't know that setting up a system of repeated testing for the adults in the school is necessarily going to be the way to go. So I am not in the position as a health policy person in our community to make those decisions. What I do think we need to think about, and one way I think parents can be really helpful in this, is that no matter what happens, there's going to be big funding needs for our schools. And I think we also advocate for making sure that we get the appropriate funding, especially to some of our poorer districts, because they have more crowded schools. They have less access to all sorts of different things that are going to make the transition, whether it be virtual school or in-person school, more challenging if they just don't have the resources. You know, for me, you know, what's the concept of what to do with a child or an adult who becomes symptomatic or is symptomatic upon arrival to school, that plan needs to be worked out very clearly. And I would think, I have confidence that as our community, we can come up with a plan to do that so that testing is done in a really efficient manner. You know, to me, having somebody have to go from point A to B to C to be tested doesn't make a lot of sense. I think this is something that we should be able to do in the schools and get it done in a quick way. But I think all of that information will be coming with some guidance from our local health department and the state as well.
Okay. And Dr. Cook, you know, it was a couple of weeks ago, I was talking to a friend thinking maybe overly optimistically that, well, you know, by the fall, maybe this saliva test will become the norm. Not that I mind. I've been tested 3 times, you know, with the nasal pharyngeal. It's fine. It's not a big deal. But the saliva test, I had this dream that, you know, everybody could, you know, offer a little saliva. They'll test it that day. You know, I'm sort of, it's pie in the sky stuff here. But the reason I ask is not because I'm asking you guys to set policy, but just for you to kind of offer your thoughts on, you know, the superintendent saying, hey, not even doctors are getting tested all that widely, so you can't really expect teachers. What do you think, Steve?
Yeah, I think it's really important to look at this. You know, schools aren't just schools. If you put this under other guidelines, you have to incorporate childcare guidelines. You have to employ or engage in the employer guidelines. And health system type of guidelines when you look at this. So I don't see it being a requirement. I would be worried how feasible it would be to get all teachers tested or staff tested prior to the school year. If they want to, that's fine. But you're talking about a big logistic lift that, again, may not help in a broad system approach. But screening people for symptoms will need to be something that is strongly considered. And the AAP doesn't recommend getting testing on staff or testing on children broadly. But there will need to be steps to consider if a child develops symptoms, how to respond to that, ordering testing, isolating. And there is some guidance for it. The key is bringing in, you know, guidance actually from other fields to bear here and look at what those experiences are and where it may guide us with implementing this in schools.
Yeah, and Ellie, you know, I know your question was on what, you know, what happens if people in kids' sphere of influence, their parents, their families aren't taking this seriously. Dr. Michael Mendoza, who's listening right now, sends me a note saying, if we become aware of a parent confirmed positive, we would quarantine kids in the household so they should not be going to school. And that's a great point from Dr. Mendoza, because it's one thing to say, hey, this child comes from a family that isn't taking it seriously, they're not wearing masks. Whatever. But I mean, if you've got a positive test at home, that kid should be home. And that will be important. As Dr. Cook has been saying, the tracing, the testing, and understanding of all the interconnected network of what happens when there's a positive test. It's going to be a lot of work, but that should be happening this fall if kids are back in schools. Dr. Tope, I know your time's short. You got a role here. Can you just offer some brief thoughts to parents like Amber, who called in to say, how do we talk to parents who don't believe school might be open in the fall? Should they start preparing now?
I think it's important that we all be prepared for school to open in the fall and have the make that the default, and then we can fall back onto backup plans if necessary. But before I leave, I'd like to just second Dr. Murray's response there about the importance of funding. I mean, we're going to lose multiple efficiencies of scale here that the current school environment has in terms of we're going to have to spread kids out to different spaces, perhaps hire on more staff, implement physical changes to the facilities, and this is all going to require some major funding from the federal government because states really can't borrow for this one. And I think it's imperative upon our federal government leaders to come up with a stimulus bill that will ensure that we can safely get kids and teachers and staff back into the schools in the fall. I think it can be done. But again, it's going to take some major thinking outside the box here, even spreading kids out to other locations perhaps. But again, that's all going to cost money and require a heavy lift because we can't just throw this problem on teachers and on superintendents and say, okay, fix it. You're really going to have some financial support and logistical support to make this happen. But I can't think of anything that's going to be more important in the fall because if parents are at home trying to work and teach their kids, it's not going to go well. You're going to see worker productivity go down, and you really can't reopen this economy without trying to figure out what to do with children. And they're going to be the ones that suffer the most if we're unable to figure this one out. So everyone needs to kind of pull on their big girl and big boy pants and work together to really push in the same direction to get something done.
Dr. Topa, pediatrician at Pittsburgh Pediatric Associates, thanks for the time. I know you're going back to work. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Have a good day.
All right. Let me get back to the phone. And if you've sent an email or you've called, we're going to try to get through all of your comments. There's a lot for Drs. Steve Cook and Elizabeth Murray this hour as we talk about schools potentially reopening in the fall and the position of the American Academy of Pediatrics, which says that if at all possible, kids should be in physical classrooms with their peers, as complicated as it will be during a pandemic. Kim in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Kim.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a first grade teacher here in Monroe County, and I'm dying to get back in the classroom in some capacity in the fall. But I was wondering if the doctors had any recommendations for class sizes that are anticipated to be, you know, 28 or 29 tiny little people in a room.
Yeah, hang there, Kim and Steve Cook. I know your time, you got to jump off and do something in a minute here. You want to take that for about a minute?
Yeah, and I'll be back on, but it's
sure.
Really important in these guidelines. We talk about limiting the contact time in the space. So, yeah, we're going to need to consider classrooms instead of 22, 12, and how to space that out and create more space, and do we need volunteers or other people that can help extend those teachers? And that's why this is going to require really creative solutions and not just on the burdens of the teachers. And it's great to hear from a teacher. And every teacher I've heard from on this issue has said, I'm dying to get back into the classroom. I want to, you know, reach our kids. So we know the teachers want to do this, and we want to make it safe for them as well as the staff and the kids. It's a great question. And, you know, it's something that we have to look at. If we can contain kids in clusters, as Mike pointed out, if a household contact becomes positive, we isolate the household. If kids are in clusters of 12 kids and a teacher in a room and they're there for a good portion of the day, if one kid turns positive, you're going to have to reach to those kids in the classroom. If kids are freely traveling throughout the school, now you have a much bigger group to reach. So this may not sound great, but none of this stuff will sound great. But keeping kids in clusters is keeping groups of clusters of kids and teachers and staff together is going to be really critical to help keep this open and going as long as possible in the in-person setting. So,
all right. Dr. Cook's going to be back in about 5 minutes with us. And before I turn to Dr. Murray on this, Kim, I hope you stay in the line because I want to get your take on everything you're hearing here. Let me do two things, Dr. Murray. First, let me read what Dr. O'Leary, who as a someone who helped write the guidelines for the AAP, here's what he said to the New York Times about this issue regarding 6 feet distancing, how many kids in a classroom. He said to the New York Times, quote, the CDC said 6 feet is feasible. The point we are trying to make is it's really not feasible. When you consider the overall health of children and really the community at large, adhering to a 6 foot rule, which would mean having a lot of kids at home, may not be in the best interest of overall health. Something has to give. From our perspective as pediatricians, the downsides of having kids at home versus in school are outweighed by the small incremental gain you would get from having kids 6 feet apart as opposed to 5, 4, or 3 feet apart. When you add into that other mitigation measures like mask wearing, particularly for older kids, and frequent hand washing, you can bring the risk down. I do think it's a balance. That's Dr. O'Leary, and let's listen, if we could, to what Dr. Mancuso from Honeyoy Falls Lima said about the idea of kids wearing masks and sitting apart, you know, whether it's 3 or 6 feet in the classroom. Let's listen.
Local YMCAs have been open all throughout this crisis, and for elementary kids, they have them put up their airplane wing arms, and they stay socially distanced by, you know, you just give a reminder, airplane wings, the kids all put up their arms, and they socially separate or physically separate. You know, mask on, mask off. You know, if you get up, you put your mask on. If you sit down, you get to take your mask back off. I think kids are pretty easy going, and if it makes sense to them, I think it'll be good to go.
All right, that's Dr. Mancuso. Dr. Murray, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that we're in a phase of risk mitigation, right? Everything we do is, if we're entering back into our environment, is going to carry some risk, but there's definitely things we can do to lessen that risk. And the question of, you know, is there a difference between 6 feet and 3 feet? And maybe there isn't as much. 6 feet might be safer, but if it's so impractical that we can't get kids back to school, I totally understand what Dr. O'Leary is saying. And I also agree with what the superintendent was saying, is that kids want to be helpers. They want to be healthy. They want to do what's right. They're happy to learn. And if something has to change a little bit, they're okay with doing it, I think, in the majority of cases. And so whether it's airplane wings, I like that. I hadn't heard that. Or, you know, drawing pictures on the floor and having things spaced out, we can have our children move through this new process in a way that I think that they'll grow to understand it and do fine with it.
And Dr. Murray, would you say that it's important to be patient with kids, knowing that, like you said, they want to be helpers. They want to do well. I mean, those of us with kids, by now we're familiar with kids saying, boy, you know, this isn't any fun, but if this is what I have to do to hang out with a friend, I'll do it. You know, like I will stay separated. I will not make physical contact. I will be outside only. Kids want that. And I think they're going to want to be back in school as much as kids may claim they don't want to be in school. Now they realize they do. And I think they're going to want to do that. Is it important for us, Dr. Murray, to be patient with them, to remind them, and I'm teachers, and we'll get Kim back here in a second. They'll have to remind, hey, get that mask up if you're going to the bathroom, or, you know, with all the little things that have to happen, I think kids will do while we are patient with maybe honest mistakes at times.
Most definitely. Most definitely. And I think one thing that we can do as parents, and something I've definitely started in my own household, is practicing wearing the mask. Because, yeah, 4 and 5 year olds might not be able to tolerate it for very long, or they might be touching their face and messing with the mask so much that it's not helpful. And those things are going to have to be a balance. And I think the AAP statement does recognize that there's going to be times where trying to do a mask on a child is just not going to be helpful. And so there's going to be some ebb and flow, and there's going to be some flux. And we know children with different sensory needs as well, there are going to have to be different expectations set for them. But I think with time, we can do it. It's going to be new for everybody. So we can't expect everybody to succeed right from the get-go, because we're all learning as we go through this.
Yeah, let me get Kim back in here to get your thoughts. Does that help? How do you feel looking forward to fall now?
I have to admit, I'm still a little bit nervous because a lot of what teachers are hearing now is we have to wait for guidelines from Governor Cuomo before we can start real plans. But I kind of think we need to have probably numerous plans going and just go with, you know, which one comes closest when the time comes. I do think with the elementary kids, they're, once you set up your community and your procedures and how you do things, the kids, they'll roll with it. So if it's something we need, you know, if we need to be spaced out more, if our morning meetings, when we're in a circle, if we need to have more spaces in the circle, I think that's all things that the kids are going to be able to do once we teach them what we're expecting. The only thing I really worry about is, you know, there's so much social emotional learning in the younger grades, mm-hmm. and working together as a team and sharing materials and those kind of things. So, you know, it's definitely better than distance learning, but it is going to be really different than, you know, your ideal classroom situation. So I think we're going to have to just accept the fact that, you know, nothing's going to be perfect, but if we can take a little burden off parents and we can get a little closer to normal, I mean, it's better than nothing.
Well, Kim, let me just say, as a parent of an elementary schooler, how grateful we are for what you are doing, for what you did this winter into the spring, and what you're about to do in the fall. It is definitely going to be harder. Everybody knows that. But we're going to be patient with you, and we're so glad that you're working for our kids. Thank you for what you're doing. And I do hope that you get a little bit more peace and comfort as you head for the fall. Thank you for the phone call.
Thank you so much.
Awesome. Just really, it's going to be hard. But, I mean, you hear Kim's attitude is nervous. But, you know, you can hear it in her voice. She's a very positive person. And I do think if we take the disposition with our kids that, hey, this is what we got to do. Arms linked. Let's do it together. Nobody wants to do it, but we have to. It's better than, kind of letting kids get too down about it, because kids are amazing. Some kids are handling this better than adults. This is our only break of the hour. We've got many more of your phone calls and emails for our guests, Drs. Elizabeth Murray and Steve Cook, who are joining us to talk about the view of pediatricians on reopening schools this fall. Coming up in our second hour, we remember the late and the great Jack Garner. Jack passed away this past weekend at the age of 75, unexpectedly. And a lot of people in this community are grieving his loss, the loss of his voice, his wisdom, his outstanding work and writing, which he never really retired from, but also his kindness, which was his most distinguishing trait. We honor Jack Garner next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Denise emails to say, Evan, listening to the doctors talk about supporting the return to school, and I think it's very irresponsible of them and of the show to be putting out there all of this stuff, given that there's very little data to support kids and transmission. Denise, I think we've said many times, and Dr. Murray was saying earlier, more data is better. More data is better. We all want bigger sample sizes. We want more study, more research, more data. We are also not in a position where we have exactly what we want right now, and you got to work with the best information you have. And we do have a pretty good set of information now that indicates that for some reason, even if we can't explain why exactly, kids don't get as sick from COVID-19 if they get it, and they don't even transmit it as much if they get it. Again, there will be a book written about this in the future. If the information changes, I'm sure, Dr. Murray, you're going to be the first to say so. But as much as we all want more data, I don't know that Denise is correct to say it's very irresponsible to talk about transmission because we don't have enough data. What do you think?
Yeah, I was talking to one of my colleagues who's a pediatric oncologist, and I think she summed it up really well, because in her patient population, there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty that they're always dealing with. And she said, you know, the only certainty is that there's going to be some amount of uncertainty as we move forward. And I think that's exactly right, that in a perfect world, we would have every piece of information we need, and we could be 100% confident in all of our decisions. And unfortunately, we're not there. So we're going to do the best we can with the information we have, understanding there are hundreds of moving parts in this, because we know school is book learning, school is emotional learning, school is a safety net for a tremendous amount of children, and there are a lot of moving parts, but we have to mitigate the risk to the best of our abilities and try to regain some amount of normal life.
Maureen emails to say, no one mentions the kids whose parents are deniers. How are the teachers going to deal with that group? That's from Maureen. And Sheila emails to say, what would your guests say to those parents who insist that there will not be a new normal this school year, that we will be going back to the old normal because all of this is overblown? Dr. Murray?
And that's a tough one. I mean, we faced that, I guess, with vaccines. And I think it'll depend on how, you know, the government and the health department chooses to attack that problem. You know, the best we can do is continue to share the facts and share accurate information and make sure children in school are given access to accurate information. There is a tremendous amount of misinformation out there. We see it on social media every day. We know that mask wearing is safe. We know that people can interact in safe ways, and we want our children to be able to do that. But at the end of the day, we cannot control what people are saying and feeling in their own households. We can just do the best we can when we are able to chat with children and give them the information that we know to be factual.
Sure. And Sheila follows up to ask, did pediatricians apply the recommendations you've been talking about to adolescent student groups as well?
I'm not exactly sure what she means by that. I mean, teenagers most definitely can learn all of this information. And I think teenagers in general, you know, we should always be, as adults in the teenager's life, working towards them being good digital citizens and having good online digital literacy too, right? Because they are consumers of social media. And if they are not able to really look in a constructive way at what they're seeing online, then they too can kind of get sucked into misinformation. So we need to make sure that we're creating good digital citizens who understand how to really critique what they read, whether it be in a newspaper, whether it be on the cable news, or whether it be on social media.
And I think what she's also saying there is just the idea of recommended reopening. We're talking a lot about elementary school. She's wondering if the AAP wants schools all the way K-12 to reopen. Essentially, these guidelines apply to all K-12. As far as I know, the answer is yes.
Correct. The answer is yes. And remember, each kind of phase of life, kids are going to have different needs. And so, you know, when you get to be in the teen years, certainly there's a lot of social and emotional situations. We also have to remember, too, that there's definitely a significant portion of kids who really did better from an emotional standpoint being home or doing virtual learning if they did have access to robust virtual learning programs, you know, because the tween years and the teen years can certainly, from a social standpoint, be incredibly challenging. And so for some, this was actually kind of a well-liked break for them from the social stressors. And so it's just, again, there's so many moving parts in this. If we can just kind of do the best we can to ensure physical safety, we can then work to ensure emotional safety and all the other stuff that goes with it.
All right. Back to your phone calls, and let's get Laura in Rochester next. Go ahead, Laura.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I just had a quick question. If we know if the heating and cooling system in schools are going to be looked at and changed because of all this?
Dr. Murray, I don't know the answer to that, do you?
I have no idea. I have no idea. Again, I'm assuming that, if that's needed, that will be part of whatever policies are put forward by the government and the health department. But that's not my wheelhouse.
But all the more reason, Dr. Murray, as you said earlier, to support as much funding as possible, because if schools are doing that, and the governor talked a little bit about ventilation systems, you want to be careful. I mean, when we talk about this, we want to be accurate on the science. I don't know the science of ventilation systems. I know that certain mega churches that were hosting presidential rallies have made over promises about eliminating all COVID in a building. I mean, you can't really do that. But the governor has talked about ventilation systems. And Dr. Murray, to your point earlier, if schools are asked to do this, they may need the funding to do it, which who knows how much ventilation would cost. I don't know. This is not, again, not my wheelhouse either. But I imagine it could be an expensive proposition, Liz.
I agree. I mean, I think the funding issue is going to be so critical here, whether it's the simple cost of PPE, you know, how meals are offered to students, I think is probably going to have to change. I don't think we're going to necessarily be able to have cafeterias with 100 plus kids in there at a time. You know, there's going to be a lot, and it's going to potentially have to come together very, very quickly. And unfortunately, that means more money.
Yeah. Laura, is there something specific that you're concerned about, just the idea of indoor spread?
Yes, with just the indoor breathing, everybody else is there. I just wasn't sure if it was updated by then or if it will be. Just curious.
Yeah, it's a really good question, Laura. Yeah, thank you. It's a really good question. It's probably one component that schools are thinking about, and you'll probably hear the governor talk more about that. But I do wonder, Dr. Murray, if this means that at least in the fall, could we see more classes say, hey, this is a beautiful day, we're going to sit outside under the tree in the shade and we're going to do lessons outside for a while? Does that make sense?
Definitely. We know the more you can be outside for a variety of reasons, COVID aside, that's certainly a great thing to do. So, yes, I do hope that we see people enjoying the outdoors when they can and knowing it doesn't necessarily last that long here in Rochester.
Yeah, indeed. Linda in Penfield next on the phone. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And boy, I know I try and keep my comments concise, but I really just got to vent on this one because it just seems that we're sending kids back to school as a matter of economic expediency and that all of a sudden schools are, well, we have to have a babysitter for our kids so we can go back to work. And that all of these different things are not being taken into account. I know because I have taught children from literally birth to adolescence and college age because I'm a speech pathologist. So I know how kids behave in all of these different buildings. That's the first thing. The second thing is, all I'm hearing is that taxpayers got to add, you know, pony up, and teachers have to pitch in, and children have to do their part. Well, you know what? If the business community and the economic community is so concerned about schools opening, then I want to see some businesses pony up some dough, okay? Jeff Bezos is the first trillionaire we got. I think if you took a zero off his salary, he's not going to miss it too much. And he can put it in the school for ventilation systems or all new buildings, because Lord knows, I don't know kindergartners who can stay 6 feet away for any length of time. So I just got a vent. I just see disaster written all over this, and I hope I'm wrong. I really hope I'm wrong. And thank you for just letting me vent.
You are more than welcome to do it, Linda. And let me just say before I kick it over to Dr. Murray, because a lot of what Linda's talking about is concern about policy and economic systems, and that is outside the doctor's wheelhouse. I will say this, Linda, there is a conversation that needs to continue to be at the forefront of this pandemic, in which we ask ourselves what we want our country to look like after the pandemic, and whether this is an economic system that we feel is fair, and whether the safety net is fair, and whether people are pushed back to work in ways that are unfair. So I understand your frustration. I hear it, and I know it's a separate conversation, but I do understand it. To the extent that we are looking at a possible disaster sending kids back to school, we are trying to address all of those points. And one of the reasons that we are even able to talk about K-12 going back is because this is a pandemic in which the disease impacts children the least and very little at all. Now, not at all. So let's talk about two specific points there. And I'll ask Drs. Cook and Dr. Murray to respond to an emailer who asked to stay anonymous. And she says, can you just please address special education needs? I work with kids on the spectrum, kids who use wheelchairs, kids on ventilators. They are at risk, and it is near impossible to distance from these kids and still be able to help them. I think Dr. Cook is back. I'd like you to start if you're there, Steve. Go ahead.
Oh, great. Give me the easy one. Thanks.
Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. And again, the recommendations from the American Academy of Pediatrics are really important because it's not just kids. There's developmental stages to kids, there's medical conditions, and we're well aware of that. And so there's a lot of consideration for children with behavioral needs, emotional needs, as well as physical needs, and how to address that. And it's going to be really important for regions, schools, school districts to assess their resources, what do they have available in terms of teachers, manpower, space, and assess their parents and families of what they have available as resources and space and needs. If there are families with kids with physical and medical needs that want to homeschool or at least keep their children at home and remote learn, there's going to be options and need for options for these. So those children that they have spoken about are really critically important, and that is also something that's getting a lot of consideration because they represent potentially a high-risk group, just like a high-risk frontline provider. Same consideration. And so do we have to take some added steps to do that? I think it's going to be really important, though, to not expect that we're going to have a regular full school year with all the testing and events and everything that normally goes on. In order to get through this, there's going to be modifications and sacrifices. And that's just a fact. So it's really important to have that as an understanding going forward.
Dr. Murray?
Yeah, the one kind of saving grace is for many of these children with highly complex needs is they tend to be in smaller classes. They tend to have one-on-one assistance. So they're already in kind of a pod environment. And so we, again, as we kind of talked about earlier, we know limiting the amount of exposures, meaning having a close-knit group of people that you're with consistently, would be beneficial. And so, at least for many of these kids, that's kind of their environment already. But as families go through and look at their children's education plans, you know, the education plans are probably going to need to look very, very different because the supports may need to be remote, or maybe a person is coming to their house, like Dr. Cook mentioned. But yes, we cannot miss any of the children, and there are groups of children that are going to need a lot more support. But I feel confident that that's being looked at right now.
Okay. Denise followed up, by the way, to clarify. She says, now that the country is opening up, we're seeing many outbreaks in older teens and kids in their 20s, people in their 20s, as they continue to gather. We have yet to see enough situations where younger kids are together often enough to get a clear idea of transmission. Schools are normally hotbeds for transmission of communicable illnesses. So why would the professionals be comfortable recommending going back to school when there are so many variables? It sounds like a science experiment to me. That's Denise's concern. Before I have the doctors address this, Denise's concern, which I absolutely hear, is countered by another listener named Kristen, who says there is data showing early disruptions in kids' lives are linked to a significant drop in high school graduation rates. I'm sure this will be worse for those who didn't have the technology or comfortable protected home environment in which to learn remotely. So if we don't do everything in our power to reopen schools, this generation of kids, kids with disabilities, women in the workforce, poor and marginalized communities will never fully recover. It will be a huge long-term setback for equity in our country if we don't reopen schools. That's from Kristen, offering a kind of a counterpoint. So I hear what Denise is saying. We all want more data. But Denise, again, I'll just stress that whether it is Iceland or even the data in this country with everything from rec centers to YMCAs to schools that were serving kids in some capacity over the summer, there is enough data that says the virus is not spreading as much among kids. Again, we'd love to know why exactly. But also, Dr. Murray, I think Kristen's email adds an important point here. It's not like, well, we'll reopen in the fall if it's safe. Otherwise, we'll just do more remote learning because that's fine. Remote learning carries huge costs, and not just, as Linda in Penfield was sort of venting about, to the business community. We're talking to kids' social emotional health. We're talking abuse. We're talking about quality of learning. I mean, Dr. Murray, there are big costs to keeping kids out of school again in the fall. Is that fair?
Definitely. I mean, the pandemic has done a great job of pulling back the curtain on all sorts of terrible things that we do as a society, right? We do not have the resources in place for many people that are needed. You know, the concept of Wi-Fi for a whole community, you know, that now is even more important than perhaps it was in the past, having access to technology for kids whose parents themselves do not know how to read. For kids who do not have a safe place to be during the day, for kids who are in abusive households who do not have consistent shelter, there are so many things to be concerned about. And that, again, this is risk mitigation now, right? There's costs and benefits to every action we're going to take. And there's going to be school districts and populations of students where moving forward, the risk is too great to have them home, knowing what we know now about disease transmission in children. And so we have to balance those risks. There might be districts, there might be private schools that are able to open in a safer way just strictly because of their physical plant or their small number of students. And there's going to be other places where it's going to be much more challenging for them to do so, but they are probably also the districts that are going to need additional support so they can get computers in the kids' hands, so they can get access to the technology they need in their house, so they can actually remote learn in somewhat of a normal way.
Dr. Cook, so many emails. We'll get as many as we can in here. Another listener asked about Kawasaki syndrome. This is something that Dr. O'Leary for the AAP addressed in the New York Times. What he told the New York Times was, in creating the AAP guidelines, he said, quote, "We talked about Kawasaki. It is by any measure a rare condition, and so it's something we do have to pay attention to and figure out what causes it and the best treatment. We should also point out that even those kids who have gotten very sick, the vast majority of them have recovered and done well," end quote. He's not saying, Dr. Cook, that it's a zero concern. He's saying it is relatively rare. The outcomes have been, thankfully, pretty good. In the rare cases where kids have gotten it, and it's probably not something that has convinced the AAP to shut down schools. Are you concerned about Kawasaki, Dr. Cook?
So the Kawasaki term really is the pediatric multisystem inflammatory syndrome that initially looked like Kawasaki's disease, but actually has a lot of other factors related to it.
Gotcha.
Kawasaki's disease mostly affects young children under five. The condition that we found in New York and we're finding all over the country, it affects all age groups. It does appear to be rare. Looking at some of the early data we found in New York and the number of identified cases, it was like 0.006%. So, I mean, an extremely low number of identified cases. Now, as we're identifying more cases, that may change. As we identify this condition better, that may change. So I don't see it as, you know, the reason to shut this down. Kids getting this condition and getting very ill from it, getting hospitalized from it. The bigger concern is that if we're not able to contain spread, then there does need to be some spread. But containing it, it's the transmission to adults. And it's not the kid or their parent per se, but it's a grandparent or the uncle or the aunt or the parent, you know, with a chronic condition that gets the serious illness from this. That is the concern. So the Kawasaki syndrome, the inflammatory syndrome, while concerning and scary, is something that is actually being tracked really closely in the pediatric medical community and trying to figure out what's happening with these kids. But it is not the reason to shut down schools.
I want to thank Dr. Steve Cook and Dr. Elizabeth Murray for joining us this hour, because I know these problems continue to be pressing for parents. We were flooded with feedback, and parents, we're going to keep having these conversations because we're days away from new sets of recommendations, New York State, regions. There's a lot that's going to happen over the summer, and we're going to stay with it and keep answering your questions with the experts, trying to stay with the data and support our kids. That's the most important thing. Dr. Murray, as always, thanks for making the time for the program.
Thank you for making the time for this topic.
You got it. And Dr. Cook, thank you. Thanks for making it work for us today.
No, thank you.
Parents, your kids are amazing. Don't forget that. They're showing us every day in this pandemic what they're capable of. More connections coming up.